enable us to comprehend time. Not only as the sum total of our individual experiences, but as the arena in which we as persons participate in the totality of social existence, impress upon us the necessity of discerning the role of the Christian community in this setting and the urgency of implementing our faith within that fleeting moment of time which is ours. Amen. It is a unique privilege for me to introduce our lecturer this morning. When one attempts to survey the impact which this man has exerted upon the Christian conscience thus far in the 20th century, one need look no farther than the productivity of his pen. Such titles as Christian Ethics and Social Policy, The Christian as Citizen, When Christians Make Political Decisions, Moral Tensions in International Affairs, Nuclear Weapons and the Conflict of Conscience, Christian Social Ethics in a Changing World. These works have provided us with a framework for the decision-making process on virtually every level of our social existence. The courage which he continues to manifest in saying to us not those things which we want to hear, but the things which we need most to hear, is a quality which I first observed in his classes during my own days at Union Seminary. It is indeed a pleasure for me to present to you Professor John C. Bennett, whose lecture this morning is entitled The Moral Pressure for Liberation.
Yeah. The word liberation is a slogan, and you can trust theologians today to latch on to slogans. We have a theology of liberation is perhaps the latest case of a theology of. We've had the theology of hope, theology of revolution, theology of liberation. This word does cover very important territory for us. In the context of social ethics, it has a very broad meaning. It begins with liberation from external forms of oppression, from poverty, dependency, powerlessness, tyranny, from systems in which most people count for almost nothing as persons, in which they are second-class citizens, often victims of humiliation. Liberation also means a new consciousness of worth for people who have been regarded as of little worth by society at large. It means a new sense of identity, new hope, a new sense of possibilities, a capacity to take initiative, to gain power. When we say liberation, there are at least three movements in the world today that first come to mind. There is, for Americans, black liberation. There's also the third world liberation, in contrast to the idea of development. And development used to be the okay word in dealing with the improved standard of living of so-called underdeveloped countries. But now, as I'll say later, this word is often rejected in favor of the word liberation. And also there is what we call women's liberation. And I think it is a sign of male chauvinism that the mention of this is likely to arouse a less serious response than the mention of the others. I hope this is not true of us. Now, I shall first say something about women's liberation. I have to admit that it is a new discovery for me, as for most males, and for most women, too. And I find it leading in so many new directions which I have not explored, that I shall not devote as much time to it as to the others. I think that my first awareness of the importance of women's liberation has come to me as a teacher. It has shocked me for a long time that when women students who often do excellent work and show great promise graduate, they cannot expect jobs that in any way fit their training or their gifts. This is true, as you know, in churches, in seminaries, in universities, as well as in the business world. My first reaction to this for a long time has been a sense of great injustice. Women who are trained in our academic institutions get jobs of some kind, but they're not promoted to positions that are suitable for them. The number of full professors in universities who are women is infinitesimal. Also, as we know, they are almost always paid very much less, sometimes a half, sometimes two-thirds of what men are paid for the same work. And there isn't the excuse that women are necessarily without other people to support. They very frequently are the ones who have to support their families. The prejudice against giving women fair professional opportunities is very deep in our male-dominated institutions. 50 years ago, men who in their day had reputation for wisdom and at least good sense used to say the silliest things about how advanced education for women or women's suffrage was a threat to civilization that would destroy the home and all the rest. Today, people don't say as silly things, but the bias remains. Often on these issues, women have been their own worst enemies. And today, women of the younger generation especially are becoming awake to this fact. I move on from simple issues of justice to a realization that in our male-dominated society, women are not regarded as full persons in their own right. Their very identity usually is dependent on their relation to men. This is often true even in the finest family relationships. But in the public world of advertising, of show business, women are presented chiefly as sex objects or as decorations of the male world. On a higher level than that, I think the conception of helpmeet necessarily suggests a subordinate place to women, or at least women get their identity in relation to the men whom they are supposed to help. Now, the next step that I take is to emphasize the profound influence of our religious traditions, wrongly used, in emphasizing the subordination of women. Our theology and our churches have great responsibility at this point. There's an overwhelming background of patriarchalism in our tradition. The tendency to see God as male and the use of male words to designate humanity, even though these may be intended to be used in a special generic sense, create a bias of mind that is inescapable. The incarnation in a man may be a problem, but this is, I think, counteracted by the fact that Jesus himself was more respectful of women, more understanding of women than most of his followers. If you take St. Paul himself, I think we must be rather discriminating here. Distinguish between two kinds of statements of Paul. For example, there is a statement about how it was wrong for women to speak in church. And then there is his statement, there's no such thing as Jew and Greek, slave and freeman, male and female, for you are all one person in Christ Jesus. Now, this first statement about women speaking in church is obviously time-bound, to use an expression of Karl Barth about many things in Scripture. It's conditioned by the culture. However, the second statement is a kind of Magna Carta for all humanity and is part of the clear revelation that comes to us through Scripture. Now, the verbal problem of using adverbs and so on is somewhat difficult, although we often make our liturgies worse than they need be. For example, I have had a contact recently with some liturgies that were made up by people at the GTU in Berkeley, and they would thank God for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the prophets and the apostles, and they'd come down, they'd thank God for Martin Luther King and Cesar Chavez and so on, but never once was a woman mentioned in the whole litany. And this is just done unconsciously. Nobody wants to leave out women especially, but it's just a habit. I try to use words like humanity rather than man in the generic sense, or persons, or people. But at times, of course, it becomes somewhat awkward. We are so familiar with such a title as the nature and destiny of man, or the phrase the doctrine of man. I don't suppose we can get away from this altogether. And I would not suggest that we cultivate a verbal purism here. But let us admit there's a problem, and let us make some concessions to this and try to change our words when we can to include both men and women. The churches have kept women in a subordinate place because of their attitude toward ordination. And some of the most foolish things are said about ordination by not your church, but by the more hierarchical churches. For example, the Bishop of California said not long ago, the Episcopal bishop, that after all, Jesus' disciples are all male, and therefore priests have to be male. Well, he's actually backtracked on that now. He, at the meeting of the House of Bishops, he actually admitted he changed his mind, but he did say women must never be bishops. Well, now the freer Christian churches like yours do not have this problem. On the other hand, I don't think they provide roles of leadership or decision making for women that do justice to the place of women in the congregations. I'm sure this is true. I know it's true of my church. I think it's probably true of yours. Now, changes are coming because this Episcopal House of Bishops voted a few weeks ago by a small majority in favor of the ordination of women. The Roman Catholic Church has a long way to go on these things, but one of the most hopeful signs is the role of emancipated nuns. Now, in this part of the country, you don't have as many Roman Catholics as we have in the places where I have lived, both in California and in New York. But I do hope that you have had contact with these emancipated nuns, because they are a very considerable proportion of the salt of the earth. Now, there's one objective reality in the world today that I think creates, to some extent at least, the importance of this issue. In the past, women very often had a many-sided and very powerful role as the managers and inspirers of households, of large families. They were not the formal heads of these households, but they often had more power than their husbands on many, many things. They often kept the accounts, and they knew where the money was spent and all of that. And they were the educators, and they were the diplomats, and they were the administrators of these households. And when this was true, perhaps it was not quite so important. But the formal position of women still involved some subordination. But today, this is not going to be the situation. Because for the most part, they will have perhaps two children. These children will go to school quite soon. The household will be small, maybe a small apartment in a city. Husband will be away most of the day. Life is very different. And in order to be themselves, women must have opportunities outside the home. And I think this is a cultural change, a sociological change. It is one reason for the emphasis upon the emancipation of women today. However, the hangover of older attitudes on the part of men and often on the part of women will remain obstacles to the justice and to full dignity for women for a long time. Three state legislatures recently, I remember two of them were Oklahoma and Arkansas, voted down the Women's Rights Amendment, and in each case it was done on biblical grounds. And I understand that your legislature voted it down yesterday in North Carolina, but I don't know what the grounds were. Now, the political aspects of women's liberation are different than what they are in the case of the other forms of liberation. In the case of black liberation, white people are pushed by the blacks, quite rightly, who are over there. They're over there, and you don't have very much contact with them, unfortunately. There's not very much communication. The Third World is very far away, culturally and geographically. But when men feel pushed by the women's movement, they are dealing with people who are right there in their midst. And when men feel threatened in regard to jobs and status and roles, often solutions will have to be worked out in private life, in family arrangements, as well as in relation to the more impersonal job market. And I think perhaps more than in the other cases of liberation, the church has a greater role in undoing what it has done. I may exaggerate that, but I think this is true. It is able, because of its history, to do a great deal, to undo what it has done. Now I shall come to the problem, which is at least more familiar conceptually to us, of black liberation. Black power and black theology have been very much in the minds of all of us here for some time, whether we are white or black. In the South, you were forced by history to face the issues of black liberation earlier than they were faced consciously and directly in the North. In the North, we used to think of this as a Southern problem. And now we wake up to the fact that blacks in the South are often more hopeful about their future than they are in the North. In fact, at the present moment, there's a movement, a reverse movement, of blacks from northern cities back again to the South. White people in the South are certainly responsible for the deepest roots of the handicaps of black people, but that's another matter. Black theology is at first a shocking combination of words. Must not theology be colorblind, we may first ask. Then we are reminded in no uncertain terms that theology written by white men has not been colorblind. Professor James Cone, who is professor of theology at my old seminary, Union Seminary in New York, is the most articulate and the most troublesome to white people of the black theologians. I was his colleague for several years, and not only as a black theologian, but as a theologian without any qualifying adjective, he has a very important role in the dominantly white theological community in which he lives. He keeps affirming that the most important theological proclamation in the United States at this time is that God is unreservedly on the side of blacks in their struggle for justice and dignity against whites. Liberation primarily means victory in that struggle. And the Exodus is the great biblical symbol of black liberation. And the Old Testament prophets and Jesus are the chief inspirers of the struggle to achieve it. Cone says many things that are offensive to white people, and they are intended to be that. In fact, if I were to take him literally, I would be silent from now on, because he says that white people just should not talk about blacks. Cone is right in saying that white theologians, even those who represented the social gospel, did not give great emphasis in their theological work to the problem of blacks in America. He says, I quote, "No white theologian has ever taken the oppression of black people as a point of departure for analyzing God's activity in contemporary America." As one who remembers many struggles among Christians in the 1930s to deal with such issues as segregation in the student Christian movement, in student conferences, the pioneering activities of the Conference of Southern Churchmen, the attempts of white churchmen to aid in the formation of the tenant farmers union in the South. I remember many of these things, many of these struggles in the 30s especially, and I think one could show that the picture is not quite as unmixed as Cohn says. Yet the best that one could say would involve only minor qualification of his view. I've always been astonished that the what was called the Social Ideals of the Churches, which was a second or third edition of what had been called the Social Creed of the Churches. It was published in 1932. It had 17 articles in it, and the race problem was only mentioned as one of several points in one of these articles. There was no sense of the stubbornness, the stubborn realities of racism in America. If we think in terms of emphasis on the issues of equal justice, of symbols of dignity for the black minority in this country, emphasis proportionate to the immensity of the problem, there was not that emphasis in white theology. If we think in terms of perception of the depths of the problem as a national problem, of the degree of the handicaps from which the black minority has suffered in both North and South, there was not that perception. If we think in terms of the ways in which segregation in the church gave religious sanction to segregation in society, involuntary segregation in both cases, it may not have seemed to be quite so involuntary in the church, but believe me, in most cases it was. We can only say that the countervailing forces in churches against such segregation have been weak indeed until the issue was forced upon the white Christian conscience by a new generation of blacks. James Cohn deliberately allows an ambiguity in his use of the words white and black to enable these words to be used as a rhetorical lash that has a great shock effect. Both words refer initially to color in the literal sense. White, however, may refer not to color, but to a racist attitude. But he doesn't easily give the benefit of the doubt to people who are white in color so far as their racial attitudes are concerned. And he is not unhappy to have almost any white person feel the lash of his rhetoric. Black also initially refers to those who are black in color, but it also refers to oppressed and suffering people everywhere, these people who suffer because of the structures of society. Yet he's glad to have the initial meaning, the one that is usually communicated because of the strategic importance of the black minority in the United States as the group for whose oppression American whites have most responsibility. In the light of this way of thinking of blackness, Cohn has rightly said the following: God, because he is the God of the oppressed, takes sides with black people. He is not colorblind in the black-white struggle, but has made an unqualified identification with black people. I think that one can, if you see the double use of black and white, you can justify that statement theologically. Perhaps it is a bit harder to understand the following use of white, which will be a shock if you haven't read this statement. But if we remember the double meaning of white, this too is justifiable theologically. He says, in order to be Christian theology, White theology must cease being white theology and become black theology. And notice this, by denying whiteness as a proper form of human existence and affirming blackness as God's intention for humanity. Well, you see, if there were no double meaning of white and black, one could not accept that theologically, but Cone is very glad to have us all feel this as a kind of whip. On the surface, Cone's black theology, as a universally adequate theology, is very vulnerable at one point, for it does not prepare the black community to see the signs of its own sin or of the judgment of God upon it when perhaps the tables are turned. It does not prepare the black community to understand how far a revolutionary community almost invariably is distorted by self-righteousness, whether it's white or black. We have here a curious tactical reversal of a saying of Jesus about the mote and the beam, which bids us take account first of the beam in our own eyes. Cone does not really do that. He asks he asks black people to take account first of the beam in the eyes of the white people. However, if we take Cone at his word that blackness equals the condition of being oppressed, then if blacks become to any degree oppressors, often the oppressors of other blacks, they cease to have the protection of black theology. Now, this doesn't all come out very clearly, but it's certainly there. However, I think for this reason, black theology on the surface is not an adequate model for a universal theology of liberation, especially for situations that as I've suggested, in which the tables are turned. Yet I have full sympathy with Cone's view that while all these criticisms may be true in the abstract, white people are not the ones who should lecture black people about their sins. Not even white theologians who are both white in color and who are not free from the taint of being a part of the system of oppression. I had an experience about a year ago in Birmingham, Alabama, where James Cone and I were speaking to the same conference. And it was a very interesting experience in all sorts of ways. It happened to be in the church that was bombed and where four girls were killed around 1963. And we were speaking there about all these issues very openly, without a trace of intimidation, with the press present, and each of us had interviews with the TV and so on. This was quite a new situation. But I happened to be in one of the meetings where Cone spoke, and somebody asked him, I don't know if it was a black man or a white man, somebody asked him, Dr. Cone, can blacks sin? And his answer was, yes, but I will not talk about it before whites. Now, this is not the place to stress this aspect of this limitation of black theology. What I would like to do would be put a statement about this in a sealed envelope to be opened later. Because I don't think that I'm in a position to lecture any blacks about anything. But yet, somehow, one does hope that their own theologians will lecture them, perhaps 20 years from now, when some of the tables are turned, or more turned than they are now. But let any criticisms of black theology be made in the proper order, and not made before the shock from black theology has done its work on white Christians. The heart of what Cone says about the identification of God with blacks, if you take the word black as having this broader meaning of oppressed people, is the same as one of Karl Barth's very important theological messages to us. Listen, for example, to this statement from Barth. He says, God always takes his stand unconditionally and passionately on this side, the side of the poor and the oppressed, and on this side alone, against the lofty and in behalf of the lowly, against those who already enjoy right and privilege, and on behalf of those who were denied it and deprived of it. Though written, and I'm speaking now about Pope Paul's encyclical entitled Populorum Progressio, The Development of the Peoples, this encyclical is written with the usual qualifying clauses that enter into papal documents, but it is a kind of Magna Carta for liberation for all oppressed people, especially people in the third world. You know, in spite of the old world pomp of the papacy, Catholics are more shaken than Protestants by the reality of world poverty. This is in part because they are present with such strength in poor countries. And it may also be because they never quite absorb the Protestant ethic. This Protestant ethic, of course, has had a good effect in some ways. It has created a certain dynamism in the world. It's gotten things done and so on. But the trouble is that those who have been stimulated by the Protestant ethic and have become economically successful always seem to have blinders on that hide from them the plight of most of humanity. But to come back to black liberation, five or ten years ago, we heard far more about civil rights than we do now. The civil rights movement associated with Martin Luther King had important successes. As I have said, Southern blacks express more hope quite often than Northern blacks because of them. It seems a long, long time since there was such an uproar as the first white students entered the universities of Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia. The battles against segregated buses and airports and lunch counters, those battles have been won. Today, in the 11 southern states, there are 1,144 blacks in public office, 10 times the number in 1965. Also, blacks who are trained, and that's very important, that qualification, blacks who are trained in many situations have an advantage in getting jobs. It is difficult, perhaps, to know just how much distress these gains. To ignore them is to be diverted from areas where advances could continue to be made. On the other hand, for white people to stress them is to be tempted by complacency. I doubt, however, if complacency really can take hold of white people who have eyes to see. For example, the conditions of the majority of black people in northern cities have not really improved. Their children are condemned to go to schools that do not educate. Many cases is true. Their young people are unemployed, 20%, 30%, even a higher percentage of them in many cities. Unemployment of young people who have come to have no hope, whether they are white or black, is a national scandal, a national cancer. We see the worst consequences of this situation in our prison populations. Blacks who are there in such large numbers are picked up by the police when they're quite young on minor charges, and then they're put in prison. And in prison, they naturally tangle with the authorities and they become revolutionary, and therefore they're disciplined and they don't get parole and they stay in prison year after year after year, and they lose hope, they lose complete hope of any possible constructive change in the American system affecting them. White people everywhere should read George Jackson's letters written in prison, in the prison in California. One of the volumes of his letters is entitled Soledad Brother. George Jackson, who died in this prison riot, was a man of remarkable intellectual gifts, of amazing stamina as a human being, a sincerely revolutionary spirit. His political judgments were not the same as mine, but mine might well have been his if I had had his experiences as a victim of injustice, of police brutality, of prison brutality. You know, people who talk about law and order, about crime and drugs, and who do nothing directly about the unemployment of youth are not serious. They deal only with symptoms, and they mislead people. They mislead probably most of the white people in our churches. We need to face one serious handicap in dealing with black liberation in its present stage in this country, and I referred to this yesterday. It is the lack of sympathy of our present administration with the people who are least privileged in our society, including the black people. This is going to be a very terrible handicap in the next period, it seems to me. There is a special problem of the so-called white ethnics. You don't have so many of them down here as we have in the North. Usually now they are said to be the Poles and the Italians and the Greeks. Irish have almost graduated from this position. They've mixed so much into the general population. But these people have been poor. They have been discriminated against. They have, however, in the last generation or so, they have gained greater economic security. They've moved out into suburbs. They feel better off. But they feel threatened. They feel threatened by the stress upon privileges for the blacks, and they think they're going to be sort of pushed out of some of their present advantages by this. Now, this is a perfectly honest and understandable fear. It's a poignant thing. And I don't think that we can deal with this with great self-righteousness. I think we just have to recognize this is one of the problems to live with. And it's true of the Jews as well. I happened to spend a few weeks ago in Los Angeles with a Jewish community. And while I had read about this and knew that this was true to some extent, I was really very much troubled by the extent to which the Jews feel threatened by anything resembling a quota system. Because, of course, take, for example, the New York City schools. Suppose you had a quota for Jews in the New York City schools. What would happen to most of them? They feel threatened. And so I think at this time we ought to take account of these poignant problems. Taking account of them doesn't mean we necessarily change policy, but there does have to be a certain empathy here. And perhaps it would be possible to suggest to these people that have recently been poor some of the reasons for the special handicaps of black people. Of course, one is simply the indelibility of color. But I think more important than that has been the systematic humiliation of black people for generations and generations, so that they lost confidence in themselves and accepted the white evaluation of them. I want to recommend very much a book by a great leader of the black community, older leader, not a militant man at all, not in any way anti-white. I'm sure he disapproves of Cone's rhetoric. I speak of President Benjamin Mays of Morehouse College.
He, you know, his father was actually a slave, but he has been, maybe he is now, the president of the Atlanta Board of Education, and this is something of a sign of a very hopeful change. But in his book, which is entitled Born to Rebel, he describes the conditions under which he lived during the first half and perhaps even two-thirds of his life with as great bitterness as any militant could have described such experiences. And just to read a few lines, he says, not only in major areas such as the right to vote, the right to economic security, the right to education, the right to decent housing was the Negro deprived, but these basic denials proliferated also in countless ways to guarantee that every Negro should be consistently subjected to humiliating injustices and insults calculated to destroy his self-respect, his pride, and his sense of manhood. And one bit of testimony from his story is very revealing. He says that his parents admonished their children, be careful and stay out of trouble. And he adds that they had only one thing in mind, stay out of trouble with white people. And we may be very thankful that a new generation of blacks in the 1950s took things in their own hands, scorned the climate of fear, assailed all the sacred cows of the system of segregation at great risk. And I hope that perhaps somehow the recent poor, that is those who, the so-called ethnics, can be made to understand this situation. Roman Catholic Church has a great role here because most of them are in the Roman Catholic Church, and I hope that this something of this sort can happen. Now, I want to hurry on and say something about the third area of liberation, and I shall have in mind especially some of the theological discussions of liberation in the context of Latin America. About 5 years ago, I became aware of the fact that the word development was resented by many Christians in the third world. And by third world, I refer to Asia, Africa, and Latin America for the most part. Development was seen as belonging to the agenda of the developed nations. It suggested that the goal of the developing nations was to become like the developed nations, and this is widely rejected. Also, development fails to take account of the extent to which people in many third world countries, not least in Latin America, need what they call liberation, both from their own oligarchies and from the domination of the United States and other northern countries. Development suggests improvement along familiar lines. Liberation suggests a change in the location of power. This is the great difference. One of the Roman Catholic theologians in Latin America who have impressed me most is a Professor Gutierrez Marino of Peru, who says this: today, the groups which are most aware think that genuine development for Latin America can be achieved only through liberation from the domination of the capitalist countries, especially of the United States of North America. This also implies confrontation with the natural allies of the USA, the national oligarchies. North American views of Latin America will have to be turned upside down in the next decade, because our fear of radical change in those Latin American countries, growing out of our fear of communism, our fear even of a rather flexible Marxism, has poisoned our outlook and gravely distorted our policies. I doubt if anyone can see ahead any pattern for change in Latin America that's very coherent. But I think one of the most helpful, one of the most encouraging facts is the Roman Catholic Church has changed mightily. 10 years, 15 years ago, I would have said the Roman Catholic Church was the most hopeful, most hopeless segment of the Christian Church. And today I would say it is one of the most hopeful segments of the Christian Church. Pope Paul, in his encyclical I referred to, has really given a basis on which Latin American Christians can struggle for liberation. Let me just read one sentence from this very important encyclical, a sentence which is a shock to many white Protestants. He says, "Private property does not constitute for anyone an absolute and unconditioned right. No one is justified in keeping for his exclusive use what he does not need when others lack necessities." And he puts this, of course, in terms of the contrast between the rich and the poor nations. And he has much to say about the need of liberation in Latin American countries. And following his encyclical, the hierarchy of the Roman Church in Latin America met at a city named Medellin in Colombia, and came out with a very strong statement to the same effect. I know from what I've heard that a good many of the bishops had to be dragged struggling into the 20th century. There's no doubt of that. They didn't all agree with this. But still, there is here a platform on which Christians can stand in those countries. One of the things which they said, which is of great importance, they said the status quo in Latin America is institutionalized violence. And therefore, they showed an understanding. They warned against overt violence. But they showed an understanding of the possible, probable use of overt violence against this institutionalized violence, which is just built into the status quo, where people are kept in a subordinate position of oppression and deprivation simply by the economic power of the oligarchy and by the structures which are just built that way. And our country collaborates, especially with those oligarchies in Latin America that are most oppressive, beginning with the government of Brazil, which is a kind of favorite government in the eyes of Washington. One of the things one can hope for is that Roman Catholicism will push Protestants in America in the next decade. It'll take time, so that they will come to have a different view of the human realities in Latin America and of the distortion of American policy in relationship to them. Now, I had planned to say some things about a very difficult problem, the problem of the relationship of liberation to violence. And I think I will just skip all that I had to say and give you, in just five sentences, some things that seem to me to be important to bring into the picture, because in the church, we mustn't take a too simplistic view of this. We must keep these various different positions together, even though it's sometimes hard to do it. Now, just simply these five sentences. First, violent injury or destruction of persons is always a great evil. And Christianism must begin here, both because they are moved by love, as a sensitive caring for all neighbors, and because they see in the specific words of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount a picture of what our life is intended to be. Secondly, when there are conditions of oppression, of institutionalized violence, as injurious coercion of people, often at 80% of the people of a country, there may be justification for the use of violence against such oppression when all else fails. Third, we should not become romantic about revolutions or about the use of violence, because often it may make matters worse. We have to study the circumstances and people everywhere when they're tempted to engage in any kind of revolution, must study the circumstances and make sure that they're not just going to usher in a period of anarchy or a period of terrible repression. And fourth, Christians are tempted to use the idea of reconciliation to paper over conflicts which are the result of great injustice and which should be acknowledged as real, which we may have to become involved in and not just cover over with some idea of this superficial reconciliation, perhaps with ourselves always on top. And then finally, even within the conflict, whether the conflict is non-violent or violent, we need at all times to prepare ourselves for reconciliation. Never should opponents become in our minds less than human. Always we should see them as the objects of God's love. Always the words of Jesus calling us to love for our enemies should guide our lives. And reconciliation must always be in our own purpose, regardless of what it is we may be involved in that takes account of the reality of a conflict. Now, in the next lecture, I'm going to deal with the problem, the worldwide problem of the struggle for peace in the context of international war.
Grant us the grace to endure the responsibilities of our freedom and the strength to bear thy grace through Jesus Christ our Lord.
We shall